So we had a session on spin hole effect, talking about spin current, definitions of spin current. Now I'm going to talk about something less controversial, something very well defined, like usual current, but in the presence of coupling. I was planning to speak about two different subjects. Well, they are both related. They are both about two-dimensional electron gas with spin-orbit coupling and with interactions. We'll see how it goes. This is the most recent work, so I want to concentrate on that. If I don't have time at the end, I'll just skip the second part. The work was done with my student Vladimir Zuzin, and the other also with Michael Reich, and the other work with another student, Abdelkhalek Farid. So this work was actually not supported by National Science Foundation, so I think they're not. And move on. This is the brief outline of the first part of the talk. So first I'll start with the motivation. And the motivation is how to determine spin-orbit coupling when it's obscured by disorder. Then I'll explain that this can actually be done with the interlayer tunneling. First I'll talk about interlayer tunneling in clean systems, then in diffuser systems. And then I'll explain that the key ingredient for the proposed thing is to have correlated disorder in the two layers. And the last part will be about the IV curves and how those IV curves are surviving the electron-electron interactions. Probably no need for long introduction about spin-orbit coupling. We are considering two-dimensional electron gas where the band structure is split into two chiral bands with spin-orbit splitting proportional to material constant and to the Fermi momentum. The question is, well, there are many proposals how to utilize spin-orbit coupling for coherent control of spins. And first thing that we need to know for that is how big is the spin-orbit coupling. In case when disorder is weak or spin-orbit coupling is large, this is easy question. You have two very well resolved subbands, and you can, for example, study Shubnikov-Tejas oscillations, look at the beating between two bands. They have different Fermi momenta. So this is not a problem. The problem is how to find spin-orbit coupling when... do you see the bottom part of, by the way? How to find spin-orbit coupling when it's obscured by strong disorder. One thing, for example, is to study localization, anti-localization transition. And another proposal that I'm presenting now is another mechanism which is anomalously sensitive to spin-orbit coupling is the interlayer tunneling. So that's our motivation to find the mechanism which is anomalously sensitive to spin-orbit coupling. And the interlayer tunneling is precisely the right thing, provided that some conditions are met. So I'll explain that even weak spin-orbit splittings can be resolved in studying IV curves for interlayer tunneling, that the required condition is that the disorder in the two layers is correlated, at least to some extent. And the funny thing is that actually this mechanism will not resolve spin-orbit splitting if spin-orbit splitting is large or if disorder is weak. And that's precisely the effect of electron-electron interactions. Short introduction first. So we consider homogeneous two-dimensional layers, and the tunneling is described by the simplest possible tunneling Hamiltonian, sometimes known as a coherent tunneling. because it preserves the momentum as well as energy, and also it preserves spin. So we assume that there is no spin flip while electron tunnels from one layer to the other, and there is no change of momentum. So that's the simplest model and the most studied one. Zhang and MacDonald looked at this Hamiltonian for two clean two-dimensional layers. And it's easy to realize that actually tunneling is forbidden if there is no disorder in the system. Applying bias to the two layers is equivalent to moving the bottom of one of the bands. And since tunneling happens with the conservation of energy, it's impossible to satisfy the conservation of momentum at the same time, because those two points will have different momentum, so the tunneling will be suppressed for any voltage, except zero voltage when the conductance has a delta function, so the IV curve has a very singular behavior. The physical reason for that is that plane waves corresponding to different energies are orthogonal to each other. Disorder helps to create tunneling current because disorder smears out the spectral functions in the two layers, so that IV curve in the lowest order in the tunneling matrix element is proportional to the integral of the overlap of two spectral functions. One is shifted by the applied bias, and both are taken at the same momentum, which is the reflection of the fact that tunneling happens with conservation of momentum. But presence of disorder smears out those peaks, and IV curves acquires this Gaussian shape, and in the limit when tau goes to infinity, we recover this delta function singularity. So, yes.
When you have disorder, you don't have translation invariance in this way, right? Then
why do we consider?
You still have.
Right, it's approximation. So we, well, actually, that's quite justified approximation because you have disorder. If disorder is weak compared to the Fermi energy, then to have both tunneling and scattering of momentum is the term higher order in disorder. So it tunneling and scattering doesn't happen at the same time. So that's why this Hamiltonian.
Okay, so basically, your disorder is where the contribution that does not transfer momentum comes from, right?
Right.
But you know, but that's a very drastic assumption. I mean, usually tunnel barriers are made, could be made from different materials, especially in this case. And the surface effect is much more important than this order. And then,
you mean surface roughness?
The usual matching of transverse momentum may be in question by but suppose you have lattice growth, you can.
Yeah, what we need is that the surface is rather smooth. So that's, of course, an approximation, but that's...
That's fine, but there's still the surface breaks the translation.
No, it breaks...
perpendicular symmetry.
We have no perpendicular momentum whatsoever. So this is all two-dimensional momentum. So all happens in plane. Sometimes the electron hops from one layer to another layer. So there is no z component of momentum. The z component of momentum is quantized near each layer.
Along conservation of momentum along.
So we are talking about conservation of momentum along the direction of the planes. So if you have surface roughness, then of course you have scattering. But that scattering only happens to the two-dimensional momentum, because the higher subbands that correspond to transverse motion are very high in energy. So they are separated by something of the order of electron volts. While the Fermi energy in this system is of the order of 10 milli electron volts.
What is the barrier supposed to be made out of? What is the barrier made out of?
It's gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide. So I'll show the structure later.
Experimental evidence of this conservation of momentum? I mean, the other extreme of conservation is non-conservation.
Yes.
Well, that's...
And that's pretty frequent approximation too.
Jim Eisenstein actually measured the IV curve for this double layer system. And then...
Zero bias anomaly, you're saying?
Well, he measured in more in a Quinn limit when tau was related to electron-electron interactions. So, and then McDonald was fitting it with theory for the ballistic transport. So at least there are experiments and looks like...
Well, if one dimension for sure, two wires, I mean, it could be the
Kelvin. Right. Mm-hmm. Good point. So it's disorder that opens up finite tunneling in this system. But important thing is that disorder is uncorrelated. Now, for example, what happens if disorder is completely correlated in two layers? Then it's easy to see that we recover the previous result. Now, it doesn't matter that the eigenstates are no longer plane waves, but the eigenstates are the same in the two layers. So states with different energies are still orthogonal if disorder is completely correlated, which means that the tunneling cannot happen for any finite voltage. So we are back to the same situation which happened in the absence of disorder, if disorder is completely correlated. Yes?
What does the meaning of the correlative disorder? How should I understand
it? It means that you have disorder potential as a function of the coordinate on this plane and on that plane. If it's the same function as a function of the xy coordinates in the plane, then it's correlated disorder. I'll get to that in just a brief moment.
Correlative disorder, as for the candidate for the correlative disorder, you attribute such kind of thing with the between two layers?
It will sit in between two layers, but just wait 2 minutes and I'll show you everything. I'm not going to hide. Ah, actually, that's my next slide. I thought it's the slide after this. So, no, it's not this slide, but it's the next slide, but it's the same picture. Next point that I want to make is how I'm going to use spin-orbit coupling. Spin-orbit coupling, even in the presence of completely correlated disorder, will break orthogonality, provided that it's different in the two layers. And that's precisely what happens if the system, consisting of two different types of semiconductors, is arranged in a symmetric fashion. So we have a gallium arsenide layer on left, gallium arsenide on right, we have aluminum gallium arsenide in the middle, which is doped. And if the system is symmetric, so that the potential barrier is symmetric, this one is asymmetric because we applied bias, but if it's symmetric, then spin orbit coupling should be anti-symmetric because it's proportional to the gradient of the potential. So the spin orbit Hamiltonian will have different signs in the two layers. So it will be opposite, which means that even in the presence of correlated disorder, the orthogonality of states will be broken, and that will open up possibility for tunneling. This is a model. We assume that the dopants are residing in the middle between two layers. So we prepare a system in such a way that we dope it not outside, but inside between two layers. If we dope it outside, then of course the potentials created by dopants will be mostly uncorrelated. So we need to put it somewhere where these dopants would create similar potentials in both layers. So this
is screwing up your sample a bit, isn't it? Because there are now very strong scattering in between and almost no phase selection.
Right. Okay, that's, I have no answer to that. That's again, I'm assuming that still the disorder is not very strong, at least not strong compared to Fermi energy, so that it, when tunneling happens, it mostly happens without momentum scattering. So that's probably I can have a parameter that describes this the smallness of of momentum scattering during tunneling compared to
you will treat the disorder perturbatively, right?
Well, in a sense, it's small compared to the Fermi energy, but it's not small compared to the spin orbit coupling, because spin orbit can be even weaker. So,
well, if you would say perturbatively, I would
perturbatively.
I would buy it. That's okay, you know.
Well, it's
of course approximation. There's no momentum.
It's perturbative compared to the Fermi energy. Yes, spin orbit is something on top of that, extra. Spin orbit coupling is not involved in the tunneling process. So the thickness, I'm assuming that the dopants reside randomly within the layer of thickness A, while the distance between the layers is D. So the smaller A is, the stronger the disorder will be correlated. So I can define the correlation function for the potentials between layers when A and B belong to left and right layers, or I can define it within the same layer. And parameter A allows me crossover between fully correlated disorder case and fully uncorrelated. So if A is rather large, then left-left is much stronger than left-right, and it's uncorrelated disorder. If A goes to zero, then of course the disorder is completely correlated. So I have a crossover between those two limiting cases.
Why do you also have exponential dependence on A in the thin layer? Like, as correlator, the thin layer also has exponential dependence on the layer thickness B.
That's because I wonder why the exponent is the same, but the exponent must be there. Because dopants are residing in the middle plane. Electrons are moving in the left plane, for example. So the distance is of the order of d over 2. So it might change from d over 2 to d over 2 minus a over 2, but it's still separated. If the disorder would be in the same plane, then of course you wouldn't have this exponential factor. But you have it because it's spatially separated. This is a brief technical transparency. I'll not dwell on it. To calculate the tunneling current, we have to calculate the, using Kubo formula, the single electron loop. The upper line belongs to electrons in left layer. The lower line belongs to electrons in the other layer. Black dot is a tunneling vertex. The energies are different by the applied voltage. The spin orbit coupling are also different and opposite in the two layers. The difference with uncorrelated disorder is that now you have to take into account the vertex corrections. Of course, you have scattering within the layers, and that's a self-correlator that gives you self-energy in each layer, but the vertex functions are given by the cross-correlator. So there is a vertex function that is dependent on spin-orbit coupling and on the degree of the disorder correlation. So it's convenient to define this difference, additional typical correlated scattering time. If it goes to infinity, then disorder is completely correlated. When it goes to a regular scattering time, then disorder is completely uncorrelated. I'll explain the importance of this time a little bit later. The essential thing that happens now is that the vertex function acquires a pole for weak spin orbit coupling and for almost correlated disorder. This pole is at very low frequencies. And of course, a pole in the vertex function always signals about some kind of new physics that happens in your system. If it's at real frequencies, like pole in the BCS scattering amplitude, then it's appearance of the bound state. Here it's in the imaginary, but small energies, so it signals about some relaxation that happens at low frequencies.
Tell us what the definition of T without the zero is.
This is scattering time within the layer.
Okay, so it's just S.
Just S, just the same integral, but SLL. Within the same.
It's not a two-inch or anything.
Two? No. Just one.
Sorry, you were saying before that you were going to go beyond second order perturbation too, but this is just a...
Not in the tunneling. I will always stick to the first order perturbation theory in the tunneling.
Yeah.
So it's a tunneling Hamiltonian formula.
I'm talking about the
impurities?
Yeah. So the question is that can you have cross diagrams?
No, the cross diagrams are small, so it's again precisely, it's perturbation theory by 1 over E Fermi tau. So I'm neglecting all weak localization corrections. So this is indeed the perturbation theory compared to the Fermi energy, but it's not perturbative compared to the spin orbit coupling. That's not required. So we have this pole at small frequency. This is very important pole. Let me first discuss briefly the case when spin orbit coupling is actually much larger than impurity. So it's a clean system. This is a total result. It looks complicated, but I just flash it briefly. And I plot the result for clean limit as a function of delta tau. So as a function of voltage for different values of delta tau. So you see, as delta tau becomes bigger and bigger, the peak in the IV characteristics becomes sharper and sharper. It's positioned at 2 delta, and it's quite easy to understand why it's 2 delta. So this is a band structure for our system. This is a the two subbands in one layer, these are two subbands in the other layer. They have different radii because the bottoms of the bands are shifted. And at the point when applied voltage is equal to 2 delta, this larger circle in one plane corresponds to smaller circle in the other plane. And since spin orbit couplings are opposite in the two layers, the chiralities are also opposite. So you need to match the counterclockwise bigger circle in one layer with a counterclockwise, now smaller circle, in the other layer. And then tunneling can happen because tunneling also happens with a conservation of spin. So now you see that if spin orbit couplings were the same, there would be nothing interesting because the tunneling would not be enhanced. So the peak occurs at precisely the voltages corresponding to spin orbit splitting. And the peak is sharp, the more sharp, the bigger the spin orbit splitting compared to the impurity scattering rate. Now, what happens in the diffusive limit? Let's first take a look at the fully correlated disorder and plot the IV characteristics versus 4 delta squared tau. So you see that for different values of delta tau, the maximum of the peak position is roughly at 1. So fairly accurately at 4 delta squared tau, independent of the actual value of delta tau, if the disorder is fully correlated and diffusive limit is employed. And finally, when disorder is uncorrelated, so this tau naught is not equal to infinity, the peak position happens at 4 delta squared tau plus tau naught to the power minus 1. And the curves are actually very weakly dependent on the degree of uncorrelation in disorder, provided that this uncorrelation is still not very large. So for very weak delta tau, for large disorder, those three curves are actually invisible on this scale, as you increase spin orbit coupling, they become resolved, and they are resolved here, but they are so close to each other that I'm restraining myself from calling it universal, but the peak position is always at this strange sum. What is its physical meaning? I'm arguing that this is so-called combined decoherence time. For those of you who know about Dyakonov-Perel relaxation, delta square tau looks very familiar, and this is the frequency of Dyakonov-Perel spin relaxation. For those of you who don't know, I just give brief account of Dyakonov-Perel relaxation. That spin relaxation that occurs when we have spin orbit split band structure but spin independent disorder. In this case, electron that scatters off impurity starts to its spin starts to precess, and that's the result of the effective spin orbit Zeeman magnetic field being dependent on the momentum. So you see that electron that was initially in an eigenstate with spin pointed along the magnetic field perpendicular to the momentum, when it scatters into some other state, its spin is conserved, but it's no longer aligned with the new effective magnetic field. So it starts to precess, and this precession is called Dyakonov-Perel spin relaxation, which involves spin independent disorder in addition to spin split band structure. Delta tau has a meaning of the angle of electron spin precession between two consecutive collisions, and the spin relaxation rate is 2 delta squared tau. Why it's quadratic in delta? It's simply because sometimes it precesses in one direction, sometimes it precesses in the other direction, so it's higher order than delta tau of the next order. And it's important that coefficient is 2. So if you look at this combined decoherence rate, as I call it, the coefficient is 4, and there is also some additional contribution from uncorrelated disorder. That's how this rate is combined. As two electrons move in almost correlated disorder, they move almost along the same trajectories. If the disorder is not completely correlated, that is, those trajectories will eventually diverge. And the degree of uncorrelated disorder is described by tau naught. So this second contribution is decoherence of the orbital wave function. So as they go along different passes, the tunneling between them becomes less and less likely. The first term is decoherence of their spin functions. So for coherent tunneling to happen, you need to have spins aligned. But Dyakonov-Perel relaxation prevents alignment of spins, so that since you have spins in two layers, each one relaxes due to Dyakonov-Perel mechanism, the actual coefficient is twice as large. So that's the combined spin, the combined decoherence time of the total wave function orbital plus spin, which is probed by interlayer tunneling. So that's a brief summary. In case of clean systems, we have well-defined, well-resolved peaks, which are nice. In case of diffusive systems, the peaks are not so well resolved. They are positioned at much smaller voltages, so that's the peak, one of those peaks. As delta tau equals to 1, the peak shifts to smaller voltages and becomes positioned at the Dyakonov-Perel relaxation time. Next question, which is very important if we want to use those curves for experimental resolution of spin orbit coupling, whether they will survive effects of electron-electron interactions. And the answer is, surprisingly, this sharply resolved nice peaks will not survive electron-electron interactions, but those dull, broad peaks corresponding to spin relaxation will actually survive. Let me just switch gears and give you sort of another introduction about effects of electron-electron interactions in interlayer tunneling. First object that was studied by Altshuler-Aronoff and Altshuler-Aronoff and Lee more than 20 years ago was the density of states. Density of states is imaginary part of the Green's function at coinciding arguments. Density of states tells you how difficult it is for a system to accommodate extra electron at a particular energy. And there are two effects that compete here, well, actually increase each other. One effect is diffusion. As electron goes into two-dimensional gas, it starts to diffuse and it has a hard time traveling away from the point where it stroke the surface because of the diffusion. So that's one mechanism that prevents electron from being easily incorporated by other electrons. Another mechanism is that since it spends lots of time close to this point, low frequency and low long wavelength fluctuations become important, and that's precisely the domain which is enhanced by the Coulomb interaction. So Coulomb interaction is enhanced at small frequencies and at long wavelengths. It's singular there. So the calculation of the correction to the density of states leads to two logarithms. One logarithm takes care of the diffusive propagation. The other logarithm is related to the long-range nature of the Coulomb interaction. And they all enhance each other. And the close to the Fermi surface, the problem becomes non-perturbative. But there is a suppression of the density of states close to the Fermi surface, which is called zero bias anomaly. The IV characteristics that follows from this density of state argument was studied by Lehner and Glasman in 97. They asked the question, well, we know the density of states. How would this density of states be evident in the current voltage characteristics? Well, the simple guess that actually you have to substitute the energy with applied bias is almost correct, but not completely. You have to calculate, in addition to those diagrams that contain the density of states, there is also, this is an interaction line, there is also interaction between the two layers. So in addition to the interaction within one layer, there is also interaction between layers, intralayer and interlayer interaction. And of course, you can define symmetric and antisymmetric channel, and it happens that only antisymmetric channel contributes to the tunneling. And this is why. You can consider tunneling as the recombination of electron-hole pair in different layers. So you need to have electron here and a hole here. They have opposite charge, so it's like a tunneling into your image charge. They screen each other, and therefore only antisymmetric channel actually contributes to the tunneling. But antisymmetric channel is not singular at small q. It's symmetric channel which is singular, but antisymmetric channel is leveled off at very small q. So therefore, one of the logarithms is cut off. The other logarithm, which is diffusive, survives, and the correction to the current voltage characteristics is singular, but it's not doubly logarithmic, it's singly logarithmic. Tunneling with electron-electron interactions without disorder was considered by Alan MacDonald and Jungwirth and they obtained simple result that this singular current voltage characteristics in the absence of disorder in interactions is actually smeared out because you have electron-electron collision time. So electron eigenstates are broadened by electron-electron interactions, and the lifetime is almost quadratic except for the logarithmic factor as a function of the distance to the Fermi surface and as a function of temperature. Surprisingly, this result was already obtained in 72 by Chaplick and independently Hodges, Smith, and Wilkins, but the coefficient was a mystery for over 20-something years. All the papers gave different answers. All had logarithmic factor, but different answers. And only in 96, precisely when Jim Eisenstein did his experiments, theorists finally decided to take a closer look at the actual coefficient, and independently this paper and Zhang and Sarma's paper found the coefficient, which was 1 over 4 pi. The easiest thing that you would think is proper to do would be to take the spectral function and take gamma spectral broadening at some characteristic energy which is equal to the voltage. And that would give you current voltage characteristic similar to what happens in the disordered case. This is not true. And the reason is that in the disordered case, the overlap between two spectral functions is determined by a fixed scattering rate. In this case, it's completely different. The scattering rate actually depends on the energy, and therefore, as you go away from the Fermi surface, the scattering rate also increases. So the result is that the peaks in the two spectral functions are not very well resolved. As you go to higher energies, they are resolved, they become resolved less and less. So the fast growth of the quasi-particle lifetime is one thing that breaks the picture. Another thing is that you simply don't have any scale. You don't have 1 over tau. The only scale you have is Fermi energy. So the IV characteristic will be wide on a scale comparable to the Fermi energy. The reason it's not actually on the scale of Fermi energy is this coefficient 4 pi. So it's broad, the only scale is E Fermi, but for numerical reasons, the coefficient is roughly equal to 1/10, so this peak is still at lower energies, but only numerical-wise, not because of the presence of some parameter. And this result is already enough to realize why those nicely resolved peaks will not survive electron-electron interactions. This scale, 1/10 of the Fermi energy, is still huge compared to the spin-orbit splitting. So on the scale of of the IV curve without spin-orbit coupling, the spin-orbit splitting will be somewhere there. So it's a broad peak, and spin-orbit splitting will be almost irrelevant on that scale. So electron-electron interactions will smear away the peak corresponding to 2 delta in the clean case. In the dirty limit, this will not be the case. Well, it looks insane, but it's a dirty limit. In addition to electron-electron interactions, you have disorder. Of course, it's more difficult to resolve it. However, this is not true. A hard way to calculate the corrections, first-order perturbative corrections to the IV characteristics, would be to calculate all those diagrams, which now have black line corresponding to interlayer disorder and interactions. But however, there is, and we actually did it that way, but the easy way is to go back into the original formula and look into the states not averaged over this order. So the tunneling in the lowest order in the tunneling amplitude is given by the overlap, again, of the spectral functions. Each of those spectral functions is a function of two positions separately. Now I can expand the spectral function over the true set of eigenstates corresponding to a particular realization of this order without averaging it. Well, it's a full set of states, so complete set of states. I'm justified to do that. And then I use orthogonality of those states to arrive to this simple formula where I have structure factors related to the m state in the presence of disorder at energy epsilon. And this is a true self-energy as a function of the number of the function of energy and the number of the state. Now, if I expand into the lowest order in sigma, to the lowest order in interaction, I should take delta function from here, and I should take I should neglect sigma in the other fraction, and the result will be surprisingly expressed through a single quantity, which is the lifetime at energy omega and at energy epsilon. So it's same type of the self-energy, but now it's averaged over this order. And this is precisely the quantity that was studied in the classical paper by Abraham, Sanderson, Lee, and Ramakrishnan. And they found a nice way to calculate it without actually using diagrams. So we can just borrow from their result. And this gamma will be a linear function of the energy. It's almost independent of the second energy argument, but it's a linear function compared to the quadratic function in the ballistic case.
Is it fair to say that you do have vertex correction? So what you've done there is to say the vertex correction cancels one leg of the sub-energy correction.
Yes, I think that's correct. So if you look at this quantity calculated by Abrahams is a sum of both the self-energy corrections and the vertex corrections. There is some cancellation on the way that the final result looks much simpler than the starting formula, but it's difficult to trace. So it's definitely I didn't trace it all the way through each diagram, but there is definitely a cancellation. So the important thing is that it's a linear function at energies which are much smaller than the scattering rate. And that will be the key. So, of course, this is just a first-order interaction correction. This is just an estimate. I can now compare this estimate to the peak position of my spin-orbit split peak in the IV characteristics, and then I can see what is the condition that this correction at the position of the peak is smaller than the height of the peak. And the correction is 1 over E Fermi tau. It's smaller than 1. And the physical meaning of this correction being small is that the peak is now shifted from delta to something which is much smaller than delta. The peak is shifted in the diffusive limit to energies which are small compared to the scattering rate. And as it shifted to this low energy domain, the lifetime broadening due to electron interactions acquires different functional form. It's now not quadratic in energy, it's now linear function in energy, and this actually protects my peak from this quick broadening due to electron-electron interactions. Now, to get understanding, I have to take this broadening at the voltage and compare it to 4 delta squared tau, and then I'll get which is positioned at the same voltage, and then I'll get the same estimate as my perturbative correction gives, which tells me that by virtue of 1 over E Fermi tau, this peak will remain resolved even even if I take into account electron-electron interactions. And the reason is that it's shifted, it's pushed to lower energies where the lifetime is linear in energies, not quadratic. As the temperature increased, then there is another mechanism of broadening, and that's in addition to the broadening due to Dyakonov-Perel relaxation time, we have also a temperature broadening because of the same Anderson, Abrahamsley, and Ramakrishnan mechanism. The only difference now is that in addition to the linear function, there is also a logarithm, but otherwise the linear function survives at higher temperatures as well. So for fully correlated disorder, the IV characteristic looks like a Lorentzian, with now the total relaxation time being given by both the Dyakonov-Perel time and Abraham's broadening. This is a plot for two different values of delta tau and different values of temperature. So the red curve is the IV curve for zero temperature and very weak spin orbit coupling. As the temperature goes and reaches like 20% of the Fermi energy, this peak becomes much broader as the spin orbit splitting gets bigger. Then even initially we had broader peak, and now it becomes even broader and finally it cannot be resolved. So the smaller values of delta tau are actually better resolved than large values of delta tau because of this electron-electron interaction mechanism. Finally, some estimates. There are two conditions to be satisfied in order for experimental observation to work. One condition you need is that the spin relaxation time, spin relaxation rate, be dominant, not the disorder relaxation. So you need this condition to be satisfied. Now, if we use our model for dopants residing randomly in the middle layer, then we can estimate how strict this condition actually is on delta tau. And delta tau has to be larger than A over 2D in order for this peak to be still there. So, for example, if we take the thickness of the middle layer to be about few atomic layers, so that's possible with modern epitaxy growth mechanisms, techniques, and D of the order of 50 to 100 nanometers, then A over 2 delta is roughly changing, is roughly 10 to 20, or is roughly 1 over 10 or 1 over 20. So delta tau that can be resolved by the tunneling is rather small. So we want it as small as possible. The smaller the sharpness of this layer, the sharper is this layer, the lower values of delta are actually accessible to the tunneling. That's a prediction. The second condition that has to be satisfied is that temperatures are low enough. The Dyakonov-Perel relaxation must be bigger than electron relaxation rate, and this gives us the upper estimate on temperature that we can still resolve our peak at, and it's given by delta squared tau times the Fermi energy. So it's for typical delta and tau in Fermi, that gives us temperature of smaller than 1 Kelvin, which is quite easy accessible. This is all concerning the first part of my talk. I wonder if I...
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
500 angstroms to 1,000 angstroms, that's a very large gap for tunneling. Is that what Jim Eisenstein's experiment uses?
That's I don't remember, but I think that that's about the right order of magnitude.
More like 10 nanometers.
More like 10 nanometers. Okay, then I have to. So if it's 10 nanometers.
Okay, but they are maybe interested also in coherent coupling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is that you should. This is incoherent, so it's thicker than 10 nanometers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if it's 10 nanometers, then for delta tau of the order of 10% to be resolvable, I need A to be not 10 nanometers, I need about 1 nanometer. So then it will become a one atomic layer, which is which I think is still fine, because my understanding is that molecular epitaxy can grow you one layer after the other layer.
No, but they cut delta tau. Well, here you can cut to a 3
nanometer. Okay, so if I stretch it a little bit, I can go to 10%, but even if it's smaller than 1, it'd still be resolvable. So what we need actually is we need A to be smaller than D to push us to the to the domain when delta tau is smaller than 1.
But the functional form of IP will not change if you make D very light, right? The tunnel will be big, so overall transmission may be a little difficult, but the signal will be big, but the picture will be there.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But the question is,
how well you can measure the current.
You have charged impurity,
so you actually have an attractive potential in the middle that you're not making use of.
I mean,
this is ionized impurity.
Right, but
that feeds both sides, so that makes the tunnel barrier not the minus.
So you're saying that actually I can go to much larger D. If we have ionized impurities in the middle, I can go to much larger Ds, because the tunneling will still be...
Maybe. Because then they can trap them.
I don't want them to be trapped, I want them to...
So you can. It's a single electron problem.
Right.
Why would charged impurity in the barrier would be transit on
them? It's just an attractive potential.
Well, since they... But, well, actually, they help you on...
Yeah.
Only on the first half of the travel, but on the second half they they work against you, because they pull it back. So they indeed pull it to this layer, but if electron wants to go all the way across it, then
yeah,
it becomes
detrimental,
right? Okay, I guess I don't have time for the second part. Even if it's small, it will take probably at least 20 minutes, and by that time everybody will be asleep, so I better...
Then may I ask an elementary question?
Sure.
I didn't get something very much at the beginning, that you had this peak at 2 delta,
mm-hmm.
Which was caused by tunneling from sort of the smaller Fermi circle to the larger Fermi circle.
Yes.
Then you said something, I guess, where does the spin flip come from?
There is no spin flip here.
Why not?
Because I have opposite chiralities, so you see the...
Why do you have opposite chiralities?
Because I set up my system in this way.
Well, you assume that the electric
field is
opposite.
And that's precisely when I have tunneling without spin flip. If they were equal and the same sign, then nothing will happen. Then spin orbit coupling would mostly be irrelevant. But by setting it this way, I can now inflate my circles so that they will coincide.
Right. In order to get that, you really need the charged impurities in the center, right?
Right. So I want this to have symmetric form. So my charged impurities help me in two ways. They create symmetric barrier, and they also provide some correlated disorder. It becomes a mess. That's an interesting question.
Looking for some infradivergence or something like
that. Right. At least weak localization without interactions can be done. We didn't look into that, but probably what you have in addition you have a Couperon, which is now due to correlated disorder, and then probably you will have some corrections that might diverge at small frequencies. So, but since it's 2D, it will probably still be logarithmic divergences. So, probably this effect it will not be as comparable as zero order in weak localization. So I think it's straightforward. You need just to integrate Couperon and to have your logarithmic divergence, which is cut off at tau naught instead of conventional tau as in the as in the usual conductivity. I think this.
What is sigma m?
M is a number of eigenstate. So it's a self energy as a function of the eigenstate number and energy epsilon.
Due to
interaction. Well, since those are exact eigenstates for disorder, there is no disorder there. So it's only interaction.
And how is that then captured in that sigma? Or is it due to
interaction? So this is a general form. How it's calculated, to the first order you have to calculate the linear function of sigma. So this imaginary function of sigma multiplied by delta and then averaged over this order. So the way it's calculated, you have your... If it's eigenstate representation, then you simply calculate the first order correction diagram, and there are no vertex corrections there. So there is no disorder in the vertexes. So it's only this. And then, of course, you have to find those Green's to write those Green's functions as functions in the number of state representation. Then, after that, you have to average it, and there is a nice technique how to do that in the paper by Abrahams. What you actually reduce this average into sort of the density-density correlation function. So you have retarded and advanced Green's functions there, which upon averaging will convert into the product of them, advanced times retarded, which is essentially the density-density propagator.
Is it related to some other object which you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is done by first going into the representation of the eigenstates. So it's a nice technique. I never knew it. I learned how to do it while working on this problem. So that's a very nice and very insightful paper.
It's very comparable to the government using interaction, right?
There is no interaction constant. That's precisely what happens in 2D. If you take the quasi-particle lifetime, there is no interaction constant, so it's just energy squared over Fermi energy times the logarithm. There is no interaction constant. It basically, because everything happens from the screened part of the interaction, where the bare interaction doesn't matter. So it's not like this for 3D. There is some dependence on RS in 3D, but in 2D it's so-called unitary limit.
But also not so for 1D, but it doesn't depend on the nature of the interaction. It's long range, short range.
It does. It has to be long range. So that's.
And the range is larger than. And I'm trying to estimate what it was close. What kind of corrections I should expect to do?
Well, if you have a metal electrode somewhere, then of course it will become dependent on the interaction strands. But if.
So you're saying that if I make it too much short range, I will see.
Right. If you
short the range should be,
Well, you have to look for typical wavelengths.
Yeah.
If this typical wavelength is smaller than the distance to the electrode, then you will see it. So the typical Q in the ballistic case are given by the energy over Fermi velocity. In case of diffusive, it's epsilon over D squared. So in order to see some dependence, you have D to be smaller than 1 over Q. Those are two different D's. D must be smaller than square root of the over energy. So as you go to lower energies, you will finally get to the to your limit.
This is actually the electron-electron interaction in the separate layers and between layers, is how I understand. Yeah, it depends on the correlation of disorder, if this is important or not. Do you see some spin effect connected to electron-electron interaction, like spin rack?
Well, we don't have spin current here.
Okay.
So we don't have spin drag. Because for that to have some effect, you need to drive some current in one of the layers, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So to have some current and then bias across the layers. So here we don't have any current that is going along the layers. So we don't have spin current, no spin drag.
You assume the structure is symmetric. Is it a crucial assumption for your discussion or not? Alpha minus alpha, but experimentally it is maybe slightly.
Yeah, so if those alphas are slightly different but still of opposite signs, then the effect still be there. But eventually it will smear away.
I'm not so sensitive to the slight.
Mm-hmm. What's important is it's sensitive to the sign. You can't have a sign approximately equal to minus, but that's otherwise the actual parameters can be flexible. Okay, I guess I now step down and connect the other laptop.